regular intervals, each of the German volunteers met Henschke in Hampstead. Paul Lindner described being sworn in as a GRU agent. "As of today," Henschke declared over a pint in the Wells Tavern, "you must remember you are working for our Soviet friends, and you must consider all questions as if you were under the command of the Red Army." Tony Roux was enlisted with the same formality and passed on everything he learned in the greatest detail to the cutout. "We had to make reports to Comrade Henschke about all methods used in the school, also about the education in parachuting, about the task assignments, about our work in the prisoner of war camps, and also about details from this JE apparatus, which we also did on an ongoing basis." Henschke passed on the information to Ursula, who funneled it to Moscow. The tool spies never met the woman sending those reports and pulling the strings, their secret spy mistress. Through Ursula, the centre knew almost as much about the tool missions as the OSS, and much more than MI6. Moscow learned the false identities of the spies, their fake papers and clothing, their equipment and the scheduled times of their transmissions. The Red Army knew where and when the spies would be landing, their contacts in the anti-Nazi resistance, and the real meaning of red stocking, hammer, and buzzsaw. They even knew the numerical code system and the piano music that the BBC would broadcast to alert the agents on the ground to their instructions. With the Cold War looming, here was an inside track on how the Americans organized clandestine operations, OSS training methods and personnel. But the most interesting aspect of the mission to Moscow was the Joan Eleanor system. Russia had no such technology. Ursula's spies might drop it into the lap of the GRU. "I reported all the details to the centre, and the director confirmed his interest," Ursula wrote. America was about to launch the last great intelligence operation of the war, and unknown to anyone in the OSS, the Russians had a secret front-row seat. Gould was impressed by the tool recruits, and like every spymaster, he felt a strong personal bond with his agents, particularly Paul Lindner and Tony Roux, the two-man team on the Hammer mission destined to drop into Berlin, the heart of the Reich. Gould wondered if he was committing the professional sin of growing too close to these men. He compiled detailed descriptions of both. Paul Lindner: face squarish, complexion usually pale. Subject notes that the fitter he feels, the more often he is asked if he's ill. Will wrinkle brow when hunting for a word, may toss head occasionally. Distinguishing marks: red mark to right of nose bridge and under left eye, received from knuckle ring at hands of Nazis. Also bayonet scar, upper right hand buttock, from SA handling in 1933. Then there was Tony Roux, a large man with greying hair and a quiet, reassuring solidity. "This was a balanced team," wrote Gould. The two principal actors in the Hammer production were ideally cast in their respective roles, reflected Gould. Entirely unaware, they were following a very different script, and an invisible stage manager was directing everything from the wings. The centre instructed Ursula to focus on the tool missions and do everything necessary to get the Joan Eleanor system into Russian hands. Within MI5, only Millicent Baggett picked up the scent of what was really going on, and then only the faintest whiff. The indefatigable sleuth of Section F2C was not privy to the OSS missions, but she had been watching Erich Henschke or Karl Castro for some time. In September 1943, she noted that although undoubtedly a lifelong communist with strong Marxist convictions, this man has so far not given any trouble. He appears to live a quiet life. Her assessment was amended a year later, when an MI5 spy inside the Free Germany movement reported that Castro was not the innocent ice cream maker he appeared. Castro was connected to the Talman Circle and received military training in the USSR and was part of the military unit of the Communist Party. She sent a note of warning to MI6. Castro is said to be an assumed name. He has been described as a brutal and violent type. Millicent Baggett put Carl Castro under surveillance. She did not trust Castro, and she had long suspected Ursula. If she caught them together, the game would be up. While Gould saw no reason to question the loyalty of his recruits, the chill of the Cold War was already blowing through parts of the Allied wartime establishment. MI5 regarded the Free German League of Culture as a communist front. The OSS officer Bill Casey, the granite-minded lawyer in charge of the secret intelligence section who would go on to run the CIA, feared that some of those recruited for this highly sensitive mission might be communists. Casey's misgivings brought him into conflict with Arthur Goldberg of the Labour branch, who pointed out that the OSS was specifically intended to recruit irregular forces, including, presumably, people with irregular views. The dispute was referred upwards to Major General William Wild Bill Donovan, founder and chief of the OSS. Donovan was a man who relished battle. He had fought Pancho Villa in Mexico, the Germans in the First World War, J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, and as New York District Attorney, the bootleggers during Prohibition. He had modelled his OSS directly on MI6. Donovan was a swashbuckler, more piratical than political. Excitement made him snort like a racehorse, and the tool missions chimed perfectly with his brave, noble, headlong, gleeful, sometimes outrageous pursuit of action and skullduggery. Like Gould, he did not give a damn about the politics of the agents, observing that he would put Stalin on the OSS payroll if it would help defeat Hitler. He had no idea, of course, that Stalin's agents already were on the tool payroll. Donovan overruled Casey. The mission went ahead. The same robust or naive attitude influenced the American decision to employ one of the most prominent German communists in Britain on a top-secret project of crucial importance. In November 1944, with the end in sight, the US Secretary of War ordered the creation of a new body to assess the economic damage being inflicted on Germany by Allied bombing, and to report on how far that campaign was eroding military, industrial, and agricultural production. The United States Strategic Bombing Survey, USSBS, did this in various ways. Aerial surveillance, media reports, and even civilian nutrition offered clues to the effectiveness of the destruction. By carefully monitoring the serial numbers of destroyed tanks and planes, it could assess the level of arms production. Goods train timetables were another index of economic health. There were some brilliant minds on the staff of the USSBS, including Richard Ruggles, a future economics professor at Harvard, and the celebrated liberal economist John Kenneth Galbraith. But what the survey team needed most was someone who understood the German economy at first hand and could provide a detailed, statistical insight into Hitler's arms industry and other key facets of Nazi production. There was only one such German in London. Jürgen Kaczynski had just published the latest volume of his History of Labour Conditions, a detailed analysis of the German economy since 1933. In September, he received a letter inviting him to the American embassy, where he was offered a job on the USSBS, a substantial salary, a smart American uniform, and the rank of lieutenant colonel. He asked for time to think it over. That time, of course, was used to alert Ursula, who immediately informed the centre. The reply came quickly. They were interested. Brother and sister were now both colonels in different armies. The tool agents were semi-secret communists. Jürgen Kaczynski was an extremely public one. Even Roger Hollis, the head of MI5's anti-subversion section, who had consistently played down the threat posed by Kaczynski, felt moved to issue a warning that those who make use of his services should be aware that his conclusions on economic conditions on Germany may be influenced by his political beliefs. The USS BS would eventually compile 208 volumes of analysis, detailing the decisive impact of Allied strategic bombing. Only 5 members of the survey, including Jürgen, had access to the full reports, which were passed on to Roosevelt, Churchill, and Generals Eisenhower and Donovan, and Stalin. The Center gave Ursula a personal assurance that this intelligence hall, offering the clearest possible picture of Germany's economic disintegration, was going straight to the Commander-in-Chief of the Soviet Army, J.V. Stalin. As the war raced to its bloody finale, Ursula was swept up in an exhausting whirlwind of espionage, child-rearing, and housework. On any given day, she might be coordinating intelligence gathered from her father, brother, Tom, the chemist, and others in her network, gathering intelligence from the tool missions while hanging out the washing, doing the dishes, and struggling to keep the domestic ship afloat at Avenue Cottage. Melita Norwood produced a steady flow of intelligence from the British Non-Ferrous Metals Research Association, which was now helping to produce a plutonium reactor for the atomic bomb project. In a letter dictated to his personal assistant, Miss Norwood, G.L. Bailey reassured the government that his team would adhere to the strictest secrecy and precautions will be taken to ensure that no unauthorized person obtains information. Letty also typed up minutes from the Tube Alloys meetings and made an extra carbon copy for Sonia. Michael was an inquisitive and intelligent teenager. How long, Ursula wondered, could she go on concealing her nocturnal transmissions from him? With a heavy heart, she sent him to boarding school in Eastbourne, telling herself it was best for the boy. Michael still yearned for his father. Gradually, as the years passed, I realized he wasn't coming back. I missed him terribly. My mother hardly ever talked about him. When she traveled to London to meet Sergei, she had to find a babysitter for the younger children. Ursula's mother occasionally stepped in to help, but in September, Berta came down with pneumonia. "Whatever happens, you should stay in hospital as long as the doctors think fit," Ursula wrote. On the nights she transmitted to Moscow, she worked into the early hours, wondering if the radio interception vans were prowling nearby. Every scrap of paper used for coding and decoding, she burned in the fireplace. To try to alleviate the load, she sent the 7-year-old Nina to a boarding school near Epping Forest. After a few weeks, the child developed a burst appendix and was rushed into hospital, close to death. For 3 days and nights, Ursula sat at her bedside, tortured with guilt, and then brought her daughter home. "I swore I would never send her away again." Len was not around to share the twin burdens of parenthood and spying, having finally been called up for RAF training. Whenever she could get away, Ursula cycled the 25 miles to visit trainee aircraftman Burton in his barracks, but found him grumpy and bored. "Seeing each other twice a month is just not good enough," she wrote. He was rejected for both pilot training and, ironically enough, radio operations. His request to be transferred to a fighting unit was also turned down. Behind the scenes, MI5 quietly blocked his every application. Millicent Baggett and her team were not going to let Burton out of the country. "Rather gloomy letters from Len," Ursula told her mother. Those morose letters were also being read by MI5. "I am arranging for him to be kept under observation," wrote Shillito, adding that the surveillance would be discreet. "I do not want any action taken that would indicate to Burton that his case is not being dealt with in a normal manner." In her optimistic moments, Ursula consoled herself that the Red Army was closing in on Berlin. The revolution would triumph, and a communist Germany would rise from the ruins. But in her darker hours, when the baby was crying and the mountain of radio work seemed insurmountable, she wondered if the war would ever end. Ursula was now a single mother and a single spy. As always, when her spirits were low, she turned in on herself unwilling to let others glimpse the shadow of depression, the strain of her secret life. She confided in no one. Her habits of deception extended to her own feelings. In her darkest moments, she lamented the impact the strange life she had chosen was having on her children, particularly Michael, who had spent his earliest years moving from country to country, language to language, with a succession of men who were not his father. "He should have had a different mother," she wrote. "He should have spent his whole childhood in one place, with a father coming home in the evening and a mother always there for him." Like every good communist, Ursula believed in anniversaries. On the 7th of November, the date of the Bolshevik Revolution, she left the children with a neighbour and travelled to London to meet Sergei, who passed on anniversary greetings from the GRU director. She would have bought a red rose, but there were none to be had in wartime Britain. Ursula returned to Avenue Cottage, cold and lonely. "I couldn't celebrate the day with anyone. My thoughts returned to the past." It was almost 2 years since she had heard from Rudi Hamburger. She dared not ask Moscow what had become of him, and the centre would not have told her if she had. She feared he might be dead, but kept her fears from Michael and the other children. It was even longer since she had received word from Johann Patra. Agnes Smedley was back in America, living in a writer's colony in upstate New York, and still propagandizing vigorously on behalf of Chinese communism. Ursula still had no idea of the fates of Shushin, Grisha, and Tumanyan. Alexander Foote and Sander Rado must still be spying in Switzerland if they had not yet been caught. All that remained to her of Richard Sorge was a single tattered photograph. On the other side of the world, in the condemned cell of Tokyo's Sugamo prison, Ursula's recruiter waited for the hangman. Richard Sorge's spy network in Japan had achieved espionage miracles. Posing as an avid Nazi, whoring and boozing his way around Tokyo, Sorge penetrated both the German embassy and the cabinet of the Japanese Prime Minister, extracting the innermost secrets of both. In 1941, he had been able to reassure Moscow that Japan was unwilling and unable to invade Siberia, freeing up vital Soviet forces for the defense of Moscow. 2 days before Operation Barbarossa, he had sent a message to the center warning that war between Germany and the USSR is inevitable. But Stalin, ungrateful and mistrustful, had dismissed Sorge's report of an imminent German attack as a false alarm. When the Germans began to suspect Sorge might be batting for the other side, the vicious Gestapo colonel, Josef Meisinger, a standout Nazi monster in a crowded field, was sent to investigate. Sorge quickly neutralized the threat by taking Meisinger on bibulous tours of Tokyo's nightlife. The chance arrest of a minor agent in his network brought an end to Sorge's amazing run of luck. He was arrested and tortured into a confession. The Japanese offered to swap him for one of their spies held by Russia, but Moscow disavowed him, denying he was a Soviet agent. It was said that Stalin did not want his rejection of Sorge's accurate warnings to get out. In Russia, Sorge's wife, Katya, was arrested on suspicion of being a German spy and sent to the Gulag, where she perished. His most important informant, the Japanese journalist Hotsumi Ozaki, was also arrested. After 2 years in Sugamo, Sorge was finally convicted of espionage and sentenced to hang. The Japanese prosecutor who had argued for the death penalty declared, "I have never met anyone as great as he was." Sorge was hanged on the 7th of November, 1944. His last words, delivered in fluent Japanese with his hands and feet bound and the noose already around his neck, were, "The Red Army, the International Communist Party, the Soviet Communist Party." During his long and brutal interrogation, Sorge had told the Japanese much that was true about his espionage career and some that was not. The great spy was repeatedly cross-examined about his Shanghai network in the 1920s, including its female spies. Sergei was unaware quite how successful Ursula had become. But he knew that if she was still alive, she would be spying against the Axis powers and in danger. "Women are absolutely unfit for espionage work," he told his captors. "They have no understanding of political or other affairs and are a very poor source of information." This was, of course, the opposite of the truth. Sergei's network had included numerous women, Ursula foremost among them. He lied to the Japanese interrogators to divert attention from his protege spy and fellow intelligence officer, in order to shield her. Sergei, most faithless of lovers, was loyal to the end, in his way. Joe Gould spent Christmas Day at Lindner's house with the other Toole spies. Everyone got drunk and sang German carols. Gould's son later described this as a moment of mutual respect between a Jewish US Army officer and his seven German recruits who shared a common goal. Except that, as the Second World War merged into the Cold War, they were already on different sides. A few weeks later, Gould asked Erich Henschke to accompany him on a trip to Paris. The liberated French capital was now home to the Free Germany Committee, and Gould was keen, with Henschke's help, to gather addresses of anti-fascists in Germany that could be used as safe houses by the spies. Together, they visited the Free Germany headquarters, as well as a group called Amicale des Volontaires de l'Espagne Républicaine, Friends of the Spanish Republican Volunteers. He brought back all the addresses they needed, unaware that his list of reliable anti-Nazi contacts in Germany had been pre-approved by the centre. Red Army intelligence was not just watching the Toole missions, it was running them at one remove, through Ursula and Henschke. And Millicent Baggett was watching them. Soon after Henschke returned to London, Baggett sent a memo to the head of Soviet operations at MI6, detailing her suspicions about Karl Castro and asking for help in finding out more about the people this known communist had met in Paris, particularly the International Brigade's veterans. "Have you any information about this French organization, please?" Baggett wrote to Kim Philby. By 1945, Philby had been a Soviet agent for 10 years and an MI6 officer for 5. Efficient and helpful, he had risen swiftly in British intelligence while passing on reams of highly damaging information to his KGB handlers. He was exceptionally skilled at throwing a spanner, imperceptibly, into the works of any operation that might threaten communist or Soviet interests. Philby's response to Baggett's inquiry on the 22nd of February 1945 was perfectly unhelpful. "At present, we have no information about the Amicale des Volontaires de l'Espagne Républicaine." The last opportunity to uncover the Soviet penetration of the Toole missions had been missed. A week later, Hammer was underway. Chapter 21, Russell of Spring. Hitherto, Ursula had always fought fascism on foreign soil. The nearest she had come to an operation inside Nazi Germany was the aborted assassination of Hitler. Now, as the war entered its finale, her spies were heading into the heart of the Reich. At 9 p.m. on the 1st of March 1945, Joe Gould and the Hammer agents arrived at RAF Watton in Norfolk. Paul Lindner and Tony Rue carried knapsacks containing 14,000 Reichsmarks, ration stamps, food concentrates, gas masks, invisible ink, and 2 diamonds, as well as coffee and 1,400 American cigarettes for barter on the black market. In their pockets were Bob Work's expertly forged papers, identifying them as Ewald Engelke of Frankfurt and Anton Vesely, a German-speaking Czech, both skilled defence workers, excused military service. In Lindner's wallet was a fake Nazi Party membership card. Each man carried a .32 pistol to defend himself against capture, and a poison capsule if that failed. Unbeknown to Gould, they also brought memorized instructions from Colonel Ursula Kaczynski. Precise orders on how, where, and when they could establish contact with Soviet intelligence in Germany. The GRU was also planning to put penetration agents into bomb-battered Berlin, and the war was moving so fast that Soviet forces might reach the capital within weeks. Through Henschke, Ursula issued each of the agents with a special password, identifying them as Soviet intelligence agents. Once contact was established with Soviet forces, they should no longer follow any further commands from the OSS and instead only obey instructions received from the Red Army for the remainder of the Hammer mission. On the airfield stood an American A-26, a lightweight bomber with the bomb bay adapted to accommodate the two parachutists. Gould was nervous. Only the most courageous and highly skilled hands could bring the Hammer mission safely and accurately to its pinpoint, 47 kilometers away from Berlin, 700 feet over the ground. In the airfield hut, the two agents pulled canvas jumpsuits over their civilian clothes and strapped on parachutes. Gould handed them his flask of brandy. The Germans each took a long pull. Gould was troubled by the sensation that he was living through a movie scenario. Both men had wives and young children, and the drama of the moment seemed to be at their expense. Even so, his account of the ensuing scene is cinematic in the extreme. It was raining lightly, and through the dark ground haze, the only distinctly visible object was the high, huge, squarish tail of the A-26 50 yards away. Paul and Tony smoked, the men talking to them quietly. 3 minutes before midnight, Commander Simpson opened the door and gave the signal. In a moment, they were standing in the propeller blast of the A-26, now poised and roaring on the runway. We saw the reddish light shining out of her bomb bay as we walked, leaning against the blast to the plane. We moved to the doors and hoisted Paul and Tony to their seats. There was too much sound for talking, and it was not the time. We reached up from the runway to shake hands with them. Now the night was absolutely clear. Suddenly, we saw the A-26 begin to move, and then she was racing down the runway. She was almost out of sight before we saw her rise, climb quickly, and bank off to the northeast. The pilot, Lieutenant Robert Walker, came in low over Germany at a steady speed of 300 mph. He flew her on her side, twisted her, banked her through to confuse the enemy radar. At 2 minutes past five in the morning, the plane reached the drop point at Alt Freisack, northwest of Berlin. The visibility was good, with patchy clouds and a bright moon. Walker opened the bomb bay, and dispatcher, Mischko Durr, tapped the two parachutists on the back, and Paul Lindner and Tony Rue jumped into the darkness. The two German spies landed in a field and buried their jumpsuits, parachutes, weapons, and the Joan transceiver. 2 decades earlier, Ursula had sat in a nearby hayloft with a group of young communists, imagining what a communist-ruled Germany would be like. By 6:30 a.m., they were jolting along in a train to Berlin, just two more weary wartime commuters. Dawn was breaking when they reached the city. Frieda Lindner was still asleep when her son tapped gently on the front window of his childhood home in the suburb of Neukölln, southwest of the city centre. She had not seen Paul since his escape from Germany in 1935, with the Gestapo in pursuit. "I knew you would come home to fight the Nazis one day," she said. The next day, moving through the shattered city from one air raid shelter to another, Ursula's spies began to collect information. Bomb damage, defences, ammunition storage depots, troop deployments, civilian morale, and above all, Germany's capacity to maintain its industry, military and commercial, under the most ferocious bombardment the world had ever seen. Allied bombs had reduced great swathes of Berlin to ash and rubble. The Red Army was poised, 35 miles east of the city, for the final assault on Hitler's capital. And yet, the city was still functioning, a dead man walking, devastated but dogged. In his bunker, Hitler continued to issue orders for the defence of Berlin, as the thousand-year Reich plunged to oblivion in a final orgy of blood. Goebbels's propagandists still daubed the walls. "Every German will defend his capital. We shall stop the red hordes at the walls of our Berlin." Lindner and Ruhe were amazed to discover that roughly two-thirds of Berlin's industry was still operative. The railway network was working. The electricity still flowed. The two spies drank it all in like undercover tourists. A week after landing, they returned to the drop point to retrieve their guns and communications equipment. Then they settled down in Frau Lindner's parlour to listen to the BBC and await the strains of Sinding's Rustle of Spring. Back in Oxford, Ursula waited for news, her anxiety steadily rising. Like all spymasters, she felt a sense of almost parental responsibility for the men she had recruited, briefed through Henschke, and then dispatched into mortal danger. Sergei had promised to alert her if the spies established contact with the Red Army in Berlin. Every week, she called Henschke from the phone box in Summertown to ask if Gould had received any information on the fate of the men. There was no news. The BBC supplied only the most general information about the march on Berlin. To try to distract herself, Ursula wrote long letters to Len, describing the minutiae of their daily lives. Peter's expanding vocabulary and strong English accent. Nina's fascination with animals. Michael's academic progress at Eastbourne. She sewed a new dress for Nina. "One of the good things about sewing," she reflected, "is that you can think while you're doing it." Her thoughts constantly swirled back to an image of two men floating down into the inferno of Berlin. On the 11th of March, high above the German capital, radio operator Lieutenant Calhoun Ankrum of the US Air Force prepared his Eleanor for her first conversation with Joan. Before climbing into the cramped compartment inside the Mosquito PR-16 bomber, Ankrum had enjoyed a non-gaseous meal of steak, toast, sliced tomatoes, and grapefruit. At 25,000 feet, an attack of wind could cause agonizing cramps. The tool missions left nothing to chance, including the digestive systems of the flying crew. Demolition charges were strapped to the equipment. If the plane was forced to ditch inside Germany, the technology would be destroyed. Joan Eleanor could not be allowed to fall into enemy hands. At 9 p.m., Ankrum switched on the transceiver. "Is that you, Heinz?" From 6 miles below, Paul Lindner's voice floated up from a wheat field outside Berlin. "Is that you, Vic?" "Can you hear me, Heinz?" "I can't hear you, Vic." The exchange did not live up to the significance of the moment, but the crackling conversation over VHF radio represented a technological triumph. For the first time, the Western Allies could speak directly to their spies deep inside Nazi Germany. Over the next 6 weeks, at intervals dictated by the coded BBC messages, the Hammer agents described what they had seen and uncovered, much of it gleaned from the underground trades union resistance networks. Berlin's defences, the road and rail systems, troop movements, and the location of still-functioning munitions plants, including a large tank factory. A shopping list of juicy bombing targets. On the 29th of March, they reported that the huge Klingenberg power plant was still operational. In a nighttime reconnaissance of a rail yard on the outskirts, they counted 26 freight and 18 passenger trains, sitting ducks for the Allied bombers. Back at OSS headquarters in London, Bill Casey was jubilant. The Hammer team had made a big breakthrough, including important air target data on a still-functioning power plant that kept key factories running, as well as details on the importance of a Berlin transportation net and key spots where Allied bombs could disrupt it. The Soviet armies were advancing quickly, and the spies scrambled to furnish any information that might degrade Berlin's defences ahead of the final assault. Lindner turned up at the rendezvous point appointed by Ursula, expecting to meet the promised GRU agent sent in advance of the approaching Soviet troops. But no one appeared. Michael came home for the Easter holidays. Ursula was Jewish, German, and atheist, but at her son's insistence, she agreed to cook the children a traditional English Easter lunch, or as near as wartime rationing permitted. Some scrag end of mutton scrounged from the butcher, potatoes and cabbage from the patch she had dug in the Lasky's back garden. With the meal cooking under Michael's vigilant eye, she walked into Summertown and, as she did every Sunday, put in a call to Eric Henschke. The tone of his voice revealed what had happened before he even uttered the code phrase she had been waiting for. The Hammer spies were in and had made contact. That meant the Joan Eleanor system might soon be in Soviet hands. Her spies were safe, or as safe as they could be, in a city under siege. Easter lunch was a most joyful affair at Avenue Cottage that year. Michael ate 6 hot cross buns. That same Easter Sunday, the 1st of April 1945, Lindner and Rue made their way to a remote area northwest of Berlin to collect a scheduled airdrop of food and other supplies. Around the city, German troops were digging in for a last-ditch defence. Ragtag Wehrmacht units, Waffen-SS, but also old men and teenage boys of the Hitler Youth. Suddenly, the spies found themselves in the midst of SS Panzer Division Hermann Göring as it clanked northwards for the final battle. A young lieutenant on a motorbike, officious and suspicious, demanded their papers. Lindner produced the forgeries, identifying them as Ewald Engelke and Anton Vaseli, and explained that they were returning to the city to join the loyal defenders. The sceptical officer told them to empty their rucksacks. The Joan transceiver was at the bottom of Rue's bag, hidden beneath dirty clothes. Laboriously, as slowly as possible, he began to empty it, sock by sock, muttering in Czech. Paul shrugged and made a remark about this dumb Czech who didn't understand German. Inside his coat pocket, Lindner slipped the safety catch off his .32. Exasperated by the delay, the lieutenant waved them on, a decision that saved their lives and probably his own. "I would have gladly shot him," Paul Lindner later remarked. On the 16th of April, with the city encircled, the Soviets launched the final offensive. The forces of the Western Allies had dropped out of the race for Berlin. It had already been agreed that the city would be divided into 4 zones of occupation once the fighting was over, and General Eisenhower decided to leave the glory of capturing Hitler's capital to the Soviets. The Allied air bombardment ceased when Soviet troops entered the city, and the Red Army artillery took over the shelling, pouring more explosive onto Berlin than the total tonnage of bombs already dropped by the Western Allies. The Battle of Berlin was reaching a climax. On the 21st of April, while attempting to make contact using the Joan Eleanor equipment, the Hammer spies were almost overrun by Soviet forces sweeping in from the south, pushing the German defenders back street by street. The following day, another message on the BBC instructed Lindner to cross into Soviet-held territory while Rue remained in Berlin. Thousands of Berliners were attempting to flee the city and being pushed back. Lindner was unable to break through the defensive perimeter. The same afternoon saw one of the last battles of the Second World War, as the Germans attempted to defend Treptow in the southeast against a ferocious Soviet assault. Lindner, Rue, and Lindner's father were caught up in the fighting and joined the attack on the German lines using abandoned weapons. Soviet troops, mistaking them for die-hard loyalists, opened fire on the trio before realizing these were anti-Nazi partisans. Soviet troops were pouring into Berlin, and a vengeful campaign of rape, murder, and destruction was underway. The Hammer mission was over, at least in its American form. That night, Lindner and Rue made their way through the ravaged city to the Wartenberg district and an address supplied by Henschke a month earlier. Vally Schmidt had been a member of the Young Communist League alongside Ursula, and they had kept in touch over the years. Ursula knew her to be a committed party member. In February, Vally had received a message via the Workers' Underground network instructing her to stand by. It was 3 a.m. when Rue, who had also known Schmidt in the 1920s, knocked gently on her door. Vally opened it a crack, and Rue whispered the code word, Sonia. On Vally's dark and deserted allotment behind the house, between a plum tree and the chicken coop, they carefully buried the Joan transceiver. One of the final messages from the OSS instructed Lindner and Rue to establish the whereabouts of Hitler with a view to killing the Führer himself in a surgical bombing strike. There was no need. On the 22nd of April, after being told that his orders for a counterattack had not been fulfilled, Hitler suffered almost total nervous collapse. A week later, with Soviet forces just 500 yards from the Führer bunker, he shot himself. On the same day as Hitler's tearful breakdown, Lindner and Rue approached a Red Army tank unit rolling into Neukölln and explained that they were Soviet military intelligence agents and were brought before one Captain Martov. Lindner and Rue later described how Martov had refused to believe their story and, after finding OSS codebooks in their knapsacks, threatened to have them arrested and shot as enemy agents. When they were finally handed over to the US 69th Division near Leipzig, they claimed to have spent 2 months in Soviet captivity. This was certainly untrue. In Stalin's army, only a madman would have failed to investigate their claim to be GRU agents, and a very swift inquiry would have established that Linda and Rue were telling the truth. Far more likely, having given the special GRU identifying password supplied by Ursula, they were taken to intelligence headquarters and fully debriefed on every aspect of their mission, notably the JE system. Within days of the Soviet occupation of Berlin, a Red Army officer appeared at Vally Schmidt's home in Wartenberg. Together, they exhumed Joan from the hole between the plum tree and the chicken coop. With bureaucratic punctiliousness, the officer presented Vally with a receipt for one half of a revolutionary new communications system. The centre sent a coded message to Agent Sonia in Britain, indicating that the pickup had been completed. On the 2nd of May 1945, the commander of Berlin's defence force surrendered unconditionally to General Vasily Chuikov, the same soldier who, as Soviet defence attaché in Chongqing in 1941, had helped to spring Rudi Hamburger from a Chinese prison. The war was over. Lindner and Rue were the lucky ones in the Tool story. The A-26 on the Chisel mission into the Ruhr Valley crashed on the night of 19th of March near the town of Schwager, killing everyone on board. Werner Fischer, Buzzsaw, successfully landed near Leipzig on the 7th of April on a mission to report on German movements and conditions inside British POW camps, including Colditz. He was immediately surrounded by Red Army soldiers who had advanced deeper into southern Germany than the OSS realized. Fischer was carrying false papers, identifying him as Ernst Lauterbach, a Gestapo special agent. He protested he was a German communist on an intelligence mission. The disbelieving soldiers shot him on the spot and threw his body in a ditch. Apart from Hammer, the only other mission to achieve its objectives was Pickaxe, whose two spies landed in Landeshut near Munich. According to Bill Casey, the agents funneled massive amounts of information about rail and road traffic, communication centres and troop movements to waiting mosquitoes during no fewer than 9 Joan Eleanor reports. Lindner and Rue, following GRU instructions, explained to the Americans that they were keen to return to Britain and continue working for American intelligence. An OSS officer, Henry Sutton, however, subjected them to a debriefing that was pointed and not entirely amicable. Their eagerness to return to Britain struck him as not quite right. These men were probably communists and had spent a considerable period in Soviet hands before being released. How could Sutton be sure that they had not become double agents? Gould might not be concerned about their politics, but Sutton most certainly was. Because of the political background of these men, there is serious doubt as to whether they could fit into our post-war German operations. As the Second World War ended and the Cold War began, tolerance of communism was turning to deep suspicion. Expedient wartime alliance giving way to mounting post-war antagonism. Even so, the Hammer agents were discharged in August 1945 with a paean of gratitude from the OSS for the heroic and extremely valuable work that you did for us. During hostilities, you behaved coolly and efficiently and displayed remarkable ability in exploiting every means for fulfilling your difficult task. The successful completion of your mission was of very great value to the armed forces of the Allies and contributed greatly to the defeat of the enemy. The OSS also patted itself firmly on the back. Contact with the agent teams by means of the JE equipment was established and maintained successfully at a critical time in the assault on Germany. Vital information was obtained as to conditions in Berlin, the disposition of troops in the Berlin area, and remaining targets for bombing. Extremely valuable intelligence was obtained. News of the fall of Berlin was greeted with unconstrained joy throughout Britain, and nowhere more than in Avenue Cottage, Oxford. Ursula had been able to follow the progress of the Toul missions through the information passed on to Henschke by Gould. The Hammer spies had survived, though several of the other recruits had perished. She had made a vital contribution to the liberation of her home city from the curse of Nazism. And, most important of all, she had coordinated a mission to steer a brand new item of American military technology into Soviet hands. She was helping Russia to build the bomb. She also helped them build the walkie-talkie. Even Len did not know what she had done. Hers was a secret, private celebration. The Laskys organised a street party for VE, Victory in Europe Day, on the 8th of May. Tables stood end to end along the road, wrote Ursula. The residents pooled their meagre rations to bake victory cakes. There were toasts with lemonade and beer, and the street was decked with homemade bunting. Ursula had never felt closer to her British neighbours or more in tune with the national mood. She made a large Victoria sponge, which Nina decorated in red, white, and blue. I shared everyone's joy. And yet, as a Red Army officer, she was heading into a new battle. History was pivoting around her. Before the war, she had spied against fascists and anti-communists, Chinese, Japanese, and German. During the conflict, she had spied against both the Nazis and the Allies. After it, and henceforth, she would be spying against the West, the new enemies in a Cold War. A photograph of the Summertown neighbourhood victory party includes a beaming Ursula, happily celebrating Hitler's downfall. One man is wearing army uniform, another raises two fingers in the V for victory sign. But behind the image of shared relief, triumph, and optimism lay a hidden ideological divergence that would soon erupt in a new conflict. Everyone hoped for a better world, she wrote. But here, our visions of the future differed. 2 months later, in the remote deserts of New Mexico, the scientists of the Manhattan Project detonated the first nuclear device in a test codenamed Trinity, releasing a blast equivalent to 20,000 tons of TNT. Among the scientists who watched the great mushroom cloud erupt into the dawn sky was Klaus Fuchs, one of the principal architects of the most powerful weapon yet devised by man. In August 1944, he had moved to the heart of the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, described by one scientist as the campus of a huge university whose faculty members were many of the most outstanding scientists in the Western world, assembled to work out how to beat Hitler in the race to build an atomic bomb. In the theoretical physics division, he worked under Hans Bethe, who considered Fuchs one of the most valuable men in my division and one of the best theoretical physicists we had. Through Harry Gold of the KGB, Fuchs had passed on every scrap of scientific intelligence to Moscow. They met in Queens, beside the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fuchs told Gould not only of the progress towards uranium and plutonium atomic bombs, but also of the accelerating research into the even more potent hydrogen bomb. In June 1945, Gould was waiting on a bench in downtown Santa Fe when Fuchs drove up in his dilapidated old two-seater and handed over a complete description of the plutonium bomb that would be tested in the desert a few weeks later. The Soviets were delighted to receive the virtual blueprint for the Trinity device. At the Potsdam Conference on the 24th of July, President Truman informed Stalin that America had built a new weapon of unusual destructive force. Stalin seemed unsurprised, which was itself unsurprising, because he already knew all about it. 2 weeks later, the US Air Force dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, and then a second on Nagasaki. The war in the Pacific was over, and the Cold War was starting in earnest. For 4 years, Ursula's neighbours and friends in Britain had been her allies. Across the rigid battle lines of the new conflict, they were now her enemies. Chapter 22, Great Rollright. Great Rollright is a picturesque rural hamlet surrounded by farmland in the heart of the North Oxfordshire Cotswolds. In 1945, it had an 18th century pub, the Unicorn, a post office, a medieval church, and a population of 243 people, mostly agricultural families who had lived there for generations. The trains of the Banbury and Cheltenham line stopped at Rollright Halt twice a day. Great Rollright is a grand name for a village that was anything but. It was quaint, remote, and exceedingly quiet. A week after VE Day, Ursula and the children moved into The Firs, a house of honey-coloured Cotswold stone on the edge of the village, with 4 bedrooms, 2 sheds, and an outside privy. The house was without electricity, telephone, or hot water. It was draughty in May and perishing in December. But roses grew in profusion around the door, and the gentle Cotswold hills rolled away from the back door. Ursula loved it on sight. Of all the places she had lived and spied, from China to Poland to Switzerland, this house, 250 years old with its thick wooden beams and low ceilings, the yard and barn and wild garden, was the closest to her heart. It was, she wrote, our first real home. Avenue Cottage was too small for her growing children. Here there was ample space, the rent was low, and a large locked cellar was ideal for concealing illegal radio equipment. The neighbours were friendly and incurious. Michael returned from Eastbourne during the holidays. Nina, smart in her new school uniform, took the bus to the County Grammar School in Chipping Norton. Peter attended the village nursery school run by the vicar's wife. Ursula planted out a vegetable patch, built a hen coop in the garden, and eventually installed a young pig. A stray cat moved in and stayed. Nina christened her Penny. As in many English villages, life in Great Rollright revolved around the pub, the 12th century church, the cricket club, local gossip, the harvest, and the annual fete. The family was welcomed without fanfare and swiftly absorbed. Befriended by a local farmer's wife, a Mrs. Moulton, Ursula began to put down roots. She remained a staunch Marxist atheist, but the family seldom missed church. 8-year-old Nina embraced Anglicanism with childish zeal. During the sermon, I sat at the front and listened carefully and believed every word. She decided to become a nun, then changed her mind and decided to be a fighter pilot. The bell ringers at St. Andrew's frequently came for tea after Sunday service. Ursula's baked scones were really very good. As she had with Frau Fusli in Switzerland, Ursula spent long hours sitting by the kitchen fire, discussing the minutiae of rural life with Mrs. Moulton. The chickens, the weather, the children. She bought some second-hand furniture and hung the Chinese paintings she had bought from Shanghai. It was strange how well the silk scrolls suited the old farmhouse. She took the children on a trip to Stratford-upon-Avon. The children were each allowed 4 fizzy drinks, 3 ice creams, and 2 complete inspections of Woolworths. Ursula insisted they also visit the house where Shakespeare was born. In the very heart of England, Ursula was becoming English, but without her English husband. Len's application to transfer from the RAF to the army was suddenly granted, and to his surprise, Burton was enlisted in the Coldstream Guards, the most feudal of all British regiments, Ursula wryly noted. He was posted to Germany and would not be discharged for another 21 months. MI5 warned Burton's commanding officer to keep an eye on him. His record is a strange one, and it is possible that he is, or has been, a Soviet agent. It is undesirable that he should be employed as an interpreter in Germany or any location where he is likely to be in contact with Russians. Len had spent most of the previous year in RAF barracks. Now he was in a foreign country. "I was very much on my own," wrote Ursula, "but I had my work." Melita Norwood's secrets from the British Non-Ferrous Metals Association flowed unchecked. Jürgen, demobbed from the Strategic Bombing Survey, was preparing to return to East Berlin, where communists would forge the German Democratic Republic, GDR, in East Germany under Soviet control. But he and his father remained usefully plugged into British political life. James, the RAF officer, supplied tidbits of technical information. The transmitter was in constant use. None of the villagers noticed the odd hours kept by Mrs. Burton, though her daughter did. "We children had to do daily chores in the house and in the garden. We came home from school each day at 4 p.m. Often at this time of day, my mother was asleep. Other mothers didn't take a nap in the afternoons, and I thought, she sends me into the garden to do some weeding while she takes a nap." Tony Rue, the former Hammer spy, found work with a defence contractor on his return to Britain. Early in 1946, he passed on, via Erich Henschke, a prototype aircraft part, a special instrument for shooting in fighter planes. Ursula stashed the object in Peter's pram, wheeled it to the woods near Great Rollright, and buried it. To her embarrassment, when she went to retrieve it, she could no longer recall the spot. Her first mistake in 20 years of espionage. But in all other respects, she was a model spy. Her radio was working well, as was the system for contacting and passing on information to the GRU. The payments from Red Army intelligence were regular and sufficient. Ursula's espionage network was running smoothly. And then it abruptly stopped. In the autumn of 1946, Ursula went to London for a routine rendezvous with the latest Sergei. The GRU officer did not turn up. Initially, she was unconcerned. "We had a special arrangement to cope with loss of contact." A few miles west of Great Rollright, the Banbury and Cheltenham Direct Railway passed over the road running between Banbury and Oxford. Beyond the first crossroads after the crossing stood a line of trees. The fourth on the left had a hollow root. That was the dead drop site, where, if a rendezvous was missed, messages and money would be left for Ursula on a specific day of the month. A week after the missed rendezvous, Ursula cycled under the railway bridge, parked her bike, and having checked no one was watching, reached into the hole. the dead letterbox was empty. It was bare the next month, too. And the next. Had the network been compromised?